This podcast is brought to you by Deepbridge Capital LLP. Deepbridge is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Please note that investments discussed are both illiquid and high risk and won't be suitable for all investors and should be considered as part of a diversified portfolio. The content of this podcast should not be construed as financial or taxation advice. We recommend investors seek appropriate professional financial advice. Any views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon. Welcome to this latest Deepbridge Discovery podcast. My name is Andrew Aldridge. The purpose of this podcast is to bring to life the people and the companies behind Deepbridge and what we do. To that end, I'm delighted today to be talking about corporate business relief propositions and solutions. And I'm joined by Rod Black, who is CEO of Propify Capital, and Mike McWilliam, who is Regional Director for Northern Ireland and Scotland at Deepbridge Capital. Rod, Mike, thank you very much for joining us. Great to see you both. Rod, we'll start with you. I think a few of our listeners and viewers will know Mike already, so we'll start with you. Can you just briefly introduce yourself and Propify and what you do?
I am the CEO of Propify Capital Limited. We are a short-term bridging lender, and we are specializing in the lending to housing associations and anybody in the social housing sector. It's been our niche for the last about 18 months. And looking forward to the opportunity with Deepbridge, obviously.
Excellent, thank you. And Mike, quickly, can you just introduce yourself again to people who don't know you? But could you then potentially just give us a bit of a summary of how and why you believe this type of lending that Rod's going to talk a little bit more about is an appealing asset class for a BR solution?
I'm the Business Development Director for Scotland, Northern Ireland for Deepbridge. And I've been ploughing the furrow for a few years now, so I'm absolutely delighted that we are just about at the cusp of launching this new product. Why did I think it was good? Well, it was actually a meeting I had with Rod. We sat there, talked about something completely different, and then got onto the subject of what he does, short-term lending. And just the more and more Rod started talking about his processes and how they lend, the more I thought, what a fantastic platform for a business relief structure. I think it's, if you're looking at a business relief structure, what you're looking for is three real cornerstones of it. And capital protection being one, IHT mitigation, obviously, but a decent return for the underlying investor. And what Rod talked about with the short-term lending and the securitization of that, it gave us absolute capital protection. IHT mitigation, structurally, we'll use an LLP. I'll talk about that in just a little while. So the investor is deemed a partner and participating in that trading activity. And a decent return. And I think we've all seen the asset-backed BR market has offered sort of the inflation plus one route. And I think, which is absolutely fine because you've got your capital preservation or protection in place. But what we're looking to do is to deliver a fair and transparent return on the asset class that we're dealing in. So we're going to be targeting a 6% net of cost to the client, which will give them a real solid return on their capital. I think the other two, and I'll briefly mention them, and we'll go into a wee bit more of the discussion, is possible redemption and impact investing. Possible redemption in where we're focusing, which is corporate, limited company investment, there is always the possibility that the company does require the cash back at some point in the future. And with the short-term lending nature of the underlying activity, Rod is looking at 3 to 12 month loans, so that past a certain point in the development of this product, there will be liquidity coming through the gate almost on a monthly basis. Underlying natural liquidity. So it just means that what we have is something that it's not going to, we don't want it to be used as a bank account, but once it's in, it starts the clock ticking on 2 year. And the company can come back to us at varying times in the future and either redeem part of or all their investment if they require. The other one is impact investing. And the more Rod and I talked about this, the more it became apparent that this investment will make a difference. This is not going into luxury residential or hotel complex developments. This is going directly into the development of social housing in the UK. So there's a massive deficit. Again, Rod will touch on that further on down the line here, but what we are focusing on is the development of social housing in the UK. So if you blend all of that together and you have capital protection, IHT mitigation, a really decent return on capital, liquidity aspects in the underlying nature of the investment, but also impact investing for clients as well.
Excellent. And Rod, Mike's touched on kind of the elements that you're investing in there in the social housing market, etc. Can you tell us a bit more about who you lend to, the types of organisations, and kind of why the stage at which you're lending is particularly interesting from this perspective?
Yeah, I'll even go a bit further than that as well.
Please.
Andrew, from the standpoint of, we've been in the bridging finance business with three different companies now over the last 23 years. And bridging finance is traditionally short-term lending, primarily on commercial and residential real estate. And obviously, at times like this, when interest rates are going higher, redemptions are harder to come by because it's taking longer to get funding through, if you can get it through at all. And about a year and a half ago, we sort of looked at the space and thought this potentially could happen. And we put all our eggs in the social housing basket, basically. And what we are in that is there's basically four to five different genres in that. There's social housing, affordable housing, which is usually 20% below private market rates.
Yep.
For key workers and basically just people that can't afford the market rates, but it's affordable. You have supported living, which has some care associated with it. You have assisted living, which does take special licenses, but that's a bit more care. And of course, there's temporary accommodation, which right now the government's spending £6 million a day housing people in hotels and barges.
Yep.
So there is a tremendous need for social housing within the UK. Pretty well the worldwide, but certainly within the UK, massive shortage, probably coming to numbers. I mean, there's a 4 million unit shortage in the UK, not all social, but a vast number that is social.
Yep.
And councils are spending fortunes, obviously, in hotel rooms and everything else. So it gives the housing associations, and that's what we deal with, is registered providers. They all have to be registered with the housing regulator. And they are basically in those four to five different genres, which gives them a different mix of rents. So it's not all the lowest form of rent. So the rents are still attractive for the social housing sector. The big thing in the whole social housing sector for us, when we looked at it as a bridging product, was very simply the ability for us to churn our money. And what I mean by that is there was a void in the marketplace with regards to small to medium-sized registered providers. The banks really weren't supporting it over the last year and a half, and certainly the last year has gotten worse with interest rate rises over the last 14 months and everything else. And what you're seeing is, unless they use their own capital, they can't make the acquisitions for the land to get the planning in order to go forward and develop a site. Planning in the UK, I'll just dodge on that for a second, is now providing it's a brownfield site. It's not an if anymore, it's just when. Because that law has been passed that if you are developing a brownfield site, especially for social, any of the social genres, then it is basically, it's a given you're going to get. It's just a matter of when you get it.
So that removes any within. Planning risk for you then, which I guess is...
Absolutely. There's no planning risk whatsoever, because that's usually something that's calculated with, obviously, planning consultants and risk valuers as to what you can get. But right now, it's that risk is taken out of the equation. So we saw a niche in the marketplace to lend to these organizations for the acquisition of the land, because the development money is quite easily accessible, most of it coming through Homes of England or GLA, which are Greater London Area grants for the various genres within the social housing sector. And basically what we saw was the ability to get in, get the planning enhancement, and then get our money refunded through the actual drawing down the grant, which would start their construction phase. They're allowed to draw down to 75% of the grant, actually for land purchase, but it would flush us out the door. Basically, they go on, build it between the grant and whatever development funding they have. And then obviously there's still quite a few. Charitable Bank is one of them. Clydesdale is another that offers social housing long-term rates at still competitive numbers. So
the point where you're lending is actually quite a short period of time, which is, as Mike said,
I mean, the planning risk is 3 to 12 months, and most of it is between 3 and 9 months.
Yep.
So our money is in and out very quickly.
Yep.
You know, I appreciate from a bridging rate perspective, we're probably in the, 12, maybe 14% category per annum, which is expensive money.
Yep.
But if you're looking at it from a standpoint where if you have a 10 million pound development and your land acquisition is £1 million before you get the planning enhancement, we've taken 140,000 of that for a year's term.
Yep.
And in that situation, while that's expensive for the £1 million, you have to look at it in the context of, it's really not, it's really only 1.4% in the terms of the GDV of that project, which is £10 million, which is why they're keen to actually get the access to the capital, even though it's expensive by their long-term rates. From a short-term perspective, 3 to 12 months, hugely acceptable and hugely doable. So we saw a niche in the marketplace for bridging where we could pretty well guarantee all our exits.
Yep.
And, you know, you don't have to be a smart lender to figure out, you can put money out the door, but getting it back in is always the key.
Yep.
And if we've got guaranteed exits from registered providers within the social housing sector, you have to take that on board as probably the most risk-free lending that we can do within this sector.
I was going to say, it takes away that further risk down the line, I guess.
Absolutely.
I guess
no question whatsoever.
Commercial terms will vary, I guess, from loan to loan and from deal to deal, effectively. But you know, what commonalities are there in kind of how you're lending, you know, in terms of how you collect your interest, etc.? When do you, you know, how do you redeem, etc.? Those kind of things.
Yeah, we lend at 70% loan to value.
Okay.
We look at the term of the loan, obviously, and we will deduct the interest, administrative charges, everything up front.
Okay.
So if you're at 70% loan to value, you're taking it out for a year. We're technically taking a year's interest up front on that. So our income is already banked in the bank. We started that an awful long time ago in the bridging sector. And primarily that was because if you were in sort of the non-status bridging sector and the people needed references for mortgages and everything else,
yep.
and they came to us looking for a payment reference. And if we didn't have it, we couldn't give it. So basically we decided to take that out of the equation from a refinance perspective and help with refinances by taking all the money up front. And our model's never changed for 23 years. That's been our model. So it's very cash flow positive. And it maintains credit ratings for the borrower, whether it's forced on them or not, but that is our terms, and
yep.
everybody's happy with it. If we're in a year-long position, our actual exposure on any one given site is a maximum of 54%.
Okay, yep. So, obviously, again, as Mike alluded to, an important factor when we are considering BR solutions such as this is about minimizing risk, and obviously you've shown how you minimize risk at the stage, how you go about doing that in terms of collecting interest, etc. But if things did go wrong, let's say, how secure are the loans? What kind of, what can you do down the line if, for example, a loan wasn't being repaid or whatever? How do you make sure that you are protecting and the downside is protected for investors?
Downside is always protected from the standpoint of we take a first legal charge, we take a debenture over the company.
Yep.
We take all personal guarantees from the directors.
Mm-hmm.
And through the debenture, we have access to call an administrator, and we would have possession of that property within 48 hours. We also work with several medium-sized housing associations,
yep.
so that anything that was in that genre would
yep.
be of interest to our other customers. So
you've got a natural market there if you needed to do something.
Natural market, a natural resale market. To be yep. quite frank with you, part of our underwriting exercises would be to look at the various clients that we have and see if it fit any of their needs, possibly even have a conversation with them without disclosing any of the facts. Would you be interested in something in this area?
Yep.
So we'd have a fairly good idea where we would be going if something went wrong. Something going wrong in the housing association sector usually means a housing association fail. And that has not happened for several years now in England. So you know, God willing, that doesn't happen anymore. But the ones we're working with, the reason we get in there is the fact that they are keeping most of their capital that they have acquired in situ, primarily because of the regulations from the regulator, the housing regulator in England, to maintain a certain capital requirement within the business and the debt to equity ratios, et cetera, et cetera. So, where you are with that is there is an element of good cash within most of the ones we're lending to, and they want to maintain that there, which is why ours is attractive on the long term scenario. Even though we're expensive for a short term money, when you're looking at the GDP and everything else, it's really not a lot of money. So rather than utilize their own cash and put themselves closer to that line of, sorry, you haven't got enough capital, what are you going to do, and having to liquidate an asset to provide it, it's better to keep the capital, utilize our money at a little bit expensive rate, but on the overall scheme of things, you know, well within their remit.
Yeah, and they're not limited by what their own cash availabilities are. They've got they've got scope beyond that. Absolutely.
Yeah,
brilliant, Rod. Mike, just coming back to you and kind of how this looks, how the structure of the service works from a client perspective, from an investor perspective. Can you tell us a bit more about the structure?
We've gone for a limited liability partnership. We're already running one successfully with different asset class. And we felt that the limited liability partnership, given all the regulatory requirements that we need to have in play, we thought that was the best structure for us. It also effectively the corporate entity becomes a partner within the partnership, and the partnership trades its trade, qualifying BR trade. It is no cost to the investor, so structurally it's clean. So whatever cash goes in, 100% is deployed in the partnership. And we found that to be really simple, really straightforward, and very transparent for the investor.
Yeah, nice and clean. Keep it as clean and simple as possible.
Clean and simple as possible.
But and then can you just talk about some kind of client scenarios? Obviously, we're talking about corporate entities needing BR solutions. Can you tell us maybe a couple of scenarios of what that might look like?
Well, it was funny because we kicked off with this as corporate. And a limited company, which is quite a can I call it niche market within a niche market. But the more we built out and the more we talked about it and the more we looked at it as a structure, it became quite apparent that limited companies are not just the only potential. So kick off a limited company with excess cash in the balance sheet. HMRC may view this excess cash deposits as surplus to requirements or needs the business, and as such it's then deemed an accepted asset, and that falls out with business relief and back into the shareholders' estates. So for a limited company, very simply, limited companies investing in the partnership, and that kicks the clock off. It starts the 2-year clock running on the qualification for business relief. Once it's there, absolutely fine, it ticks away, and that can sit in play on the balance sheet for as long as the company won. It also does another couple of things, not maybe so positive as it used to be, but what used to be entrepreneur's relief, it used to be able to recapture that for the cash element as well on the resale of a business. So it was really, really quite a positive aspect.
And I guess there's two elements in that, isn't there? There is the potential of the element of cash within the business not qualifying for business relief, and therefore there's a BR liability element.
Yeah.
And then there could be the fact that disqualification could disqualify the whole company from being BR qualifying. It's not just about the amount of cash. I guess it could be twofold. It could be the whole company could be disqualified.
Absolutely right. And it just does depend on the percentage of to value of cash in the company. HMRC are becoming way more strict on this particular area than they had been in the past. So we've seen quite a number of inquiries coming through the gate. And again, the more I talk with Ron about this and the journey we kicked off on for this particular strategy, it became really exciting. And there's a lot of potential cash out there sat on balance sheets. And it's a simple question for the advisor. how much cash have you got on your balance sheet, and potential opportunity to look for solutions for that particular company.
And of course, business relief is a 2-year play for tax relief, from HT tax relief. But ultimately, if the company previously was BR qualifying and then maybe suddenly grew too much cash to be non-BR qualifying, actually going back in, they could be IHT exempt from day one. You might not have to wait the full 2 years, but I guess case by case scenarios would have to be checked, but that could be a scenario.
Absolutely, but that basis of case by case, it throws up opportunity all over the place. And where, quite interestingly, we had it limited to limited companies. Yeah. When we started talking, so individuals with cash wouldn't be kind of called acceptable to the partnership. However, what we did find working with some tax advisors, and these guys are structuring family investment companies. Yep. And hopefully I think we are going to be running a session with a tax expert on this for some of the opportunities in the future. There's links in beautifully with this, where individuals are selling companies for significant chunks of cash. And it's about how to structure that going forward. So the family investment company is the structure that will give the family who have sold the business future tax planning, generational tax planning opportunities. But you've still got the cash that is sat within the estate. And underneath the family investment company, because it's a corporate, they can invest in the limited liability partnership. And in this case,
they need something which is BR qualifying.
It has the ability to get out of the estate immediately because of the rollover relief from one BR qualifying asset to another BR qualifying asset. So it's really, really efficient and effective for those that have sold companies. Brilliant. And also the structure of our limited liability partnership, with Rod's inherent liquidity spinning around, they can put a large chunk of that in and decide what they're going to do with the money 8, 9, 10, 12 months down the line.
Yep,
absolutely. So it becomes a really, really effective tool. So not only limited companies and also partnerships, but also individuals that have significant cash that are looking to build family investment companies, they need business relief qualifying assets, which this of course is.
Of course, the important bit there is that it is a case by case basis. So tax advice is critically important as part of this.
Absolutely, and it's with that sort of level of investment, then you'd want decent tax advisors in play to structurally put together the right process going forward.
Brilliant. Excellent. Thank you, Mike. That's really, really useful. And as you said, we're hoping to do a future podcast regarding some specifics with some external tax advisors to go through those as well, which would be very useful. Rod, coming back to yourself and kind of, you've done several investments like this before. Can you just tell a bit more about your specific track record and kind of how that's worked?
Yeah, as we stand right now, we've done probably between 6 and 8 housing association investments over the last year. And they've all worked out great. There's been no defaults on any of them. And they've worked out really, really well. Primarily in the 6 to 9 month range before we get to planning. Okay. They've all been on acquisition of land sites which needed enhancement of planning. Most of it has been going for a detailed I think all of them had outline planning, but they needed obviously a detailed spec. And usually within that detailed spec, we apply for some additional units are applied for by the client. So from that perspective, they've all been successful. They have all taken between 6 and 9 months. And it's been a really good circulation of money for us. It takes an awful lot of the worry out, because we know that once they we give them the money for the land, they start their application with either Homes of England or the GLA for the grants, and by the time the planning's through, the grants are ready to draw. So it's something that we've never had in our sector before, and it's technically government backing exits, so it's as good as it gets.
Yeah, brilliant. And I guess kind of looking forward, what are your thoughts about the future of this market and lending in the social housing market? What does the future look like?
Future for us looks incredibly bright in that sector, just primarily because of the amount of need for property. Yep. We are not going to supply that need in the next 10 years.
Yep.
Every year we'll try to provide what we can, and obviously the industry will do the same. But there is such a deficit that there is probably a 10-year play in this right now, as evidenced by the amount of money the government's trying to throw at this to get people started to build it. An awful lot in the past, developers have been reluctant to do schemes, that had social housing on it. But, it's the only sector that's attracting huge grants. The grants in this sector range anywhere from 40,000 to 200,000, depending on what borough you're in London and the need. And that's per unit, that's per unit granted planning. And they're big, big numbers. You can almost build it for those kind of numbers. Yep. So from that perspective, the risk is taken well and well out of it, but it only applies to housing associations.
Yep.
So most builders are starting to, be a bit more receptive to a social housing element within the development schemes. And an awful lot of the boroughs are looking at some big developments being purely for housing association and the different genres. It's not all social housing. Let's be very specific about that, because the income split, you need a mixed scheme unit. So there will be an awful lot of key worker and affordable units in that, just so that, doctors, junior doctors, nurses, teachers, they can all get accommodation within proximity to their work. So these are all key factors of, this government's plan going forward. And obviously, if there's a new government coming in a year's time or 2 years' time, whenever they call the election, I would think that that's still the biggest need within this country. So I see certainly a decade's worth of continuation within this sector, and hopefully, perhaps even greater incentives from the government to encourage more people into it. So I see a good future for this for at least the next 10 years, because there's such a shortage.
And I'm guessing, from what you're saying, et cetera, that this is predominantly focused on kind of London market currently. But
well, right now, London market's throwing bigger money at it. We've done six games over the last 2 years in Liverpool, and they've worked out fine as well with Liverpool Council backing them. So there's a need all over the place. One of the schemes in Liverpool was actually taken up by a London borough for temporary accommodation because they just had nowhere else to put them. It's throughout England there is an awful lot of cooperation between the different councils, so it's not necessarily your home council is taking it, but the need is just astronomical. So it's working with the housing associations that have these contacts within the various councils, be it London or anywhere else in the country, and you'll find that take up is not a problem.
Yep.
Most of the actual residing councils will give you nomination agreements if you're involved with a registered provider and you're grant funded by Homes of England. It's technically an automatic, so you will get grant funding. And then you've got basically a no void scenario in your letting, because if you get a void, it's filled off the waiting list from council, which all have waiting lists of tens of thousands. So there is absolutely, there's no shortage of tenants to go into these.
No, and as you alluded to, it's coming kind of the changing dynamic of what those tenants might look like. It is professionals. It is it's not necessarily the traditional individuals or demographics that maybe people used to associate with social housing, etc. This is a problem which is affecting all walks of life.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Rod. So really interesting, but the bit that everyone always tunes into our podcast for is for the last question that we ask everyone. As much as you've said interesting stuff, nobody's interested once you get to the last question. The Dietrich dinner party is what we ask all of our guests on here. If you could invite three people to the Dietrich dinner party, dead or alive, but no friends or family, because we don't offend anyone who wasn't invited, who would they be and why? So Rod, if you can tell us who your three.
Three people. Absolutely. Three people.
Yeah.
Michael Gove.
Okay.
For leveling up, and we can have a chat more about his plans for the future for social housing.
Okay.
Interesting. It's a good question. Three people.
I can genuinely say nobody else on this podcast has suggested having dinner with Michael Gove. So,
I would do that only because he's the guy in charge right now. So, with the checkbook, so I would that conversation with him.
A vested interest is absolutely a genuine reason. That's good.
Yeah. So, from that perspective, that's why he would be there. That's a really good question. Who would I like to have dinner with?
We'll edit all this bit out. That's fine.
I would say Bill Clinton.
Okay. Yep. Why Bill Clinton?
I just found him to be, apart from his problems, but I thought he was one of America's better presidents, and I have heard him speak before, and he is genuinely a wonderful after-dinner speaker, and I think would be a very interesting dinner companion to have a conversation with.
I agree. And he can deny everything afterwards. So, yeah.
And he can deny everything afterwards. And probably Sir Alex Ferguson, because I'm a Man U supporter. So.
Excellent. No, absolutely. I completely agree on that.
And also congratulations to the English women for winning their semifinal 3-1.
Excellent. Good. This isn't going out today, so we'll edit that out for being time sensitive.
Yeah, we'll edit that out. Fair enough. Yeah.
And Mike, yourself, who are you bringing to the dinner party?
Yeah, nothing so highbrow politicians. This is one of the most difficult questions. Who would you invite to the Deep Bridge dinner? I'll go rugby, music, and comedy. Mm-hmm. Rugby, Sir Ian McGeechan Geach. Yep. Just as a player, he played with the unbeaten Lions in South Africa and played with some of the greats, absolute legends of the game. And then went on to manage a successful Lions tour of South Africa, and then Scotland, the Grand Slam with the great Jim Telfer alongside. So I'd love to hear some of the on tour stuff. That would be brilliant. Music, Paul Rodgers.
Okay. Yep.
Founding member of Free, and at the age of like about 19, they wrote All Right Now, which still stands the test of time. Went on to be part of the supergroup Bad Company, and is still going strong. I've seen him a couple of times, and he is a phenomenal voice. Brilliant. So love to have him up at the dinner table.
And comedy?
What's that?
And comedy?
Comedy, yes. Probably the most invited dinner guest, I guess, on the planet, it would have to be Billy Connolly.
Absolutely.
Just as a raconteur. I grew up in the 70s, and it was Parky and Connolly, and I just loved that particular banter. Seen him live as well, yep. And he's a phenomenon.
Yep.
So in his heyday, with his banana wellies and his banjo, a great dinner guest.
Even if he brings his incontinence trousers with him, that's fine as well.
They would be issued at the door for everyone.
Indeed. Good. Gents, thank you very much for your time today. Really appreciate your time talking to us. And we'll look forward to catching up with you again in due course. So thank you very much. Thank you for joining us. If you have any topics you'd like discussing on future podcasts, please email us at discovery@deepbridgecapital.com. This podcast was brought to you by Deepbridge Capital LLP. Deepbridge is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Please note that investments discussed are both illiquid and high risk and won't be suitable for all investors and should be considered as part of a diversified portfolio. The content of this podcast should not be construed as financial or taxation advice. We recommend investors seek appropriate professional financial advice. Any views expressed may no longer be current and may have already been acted upon.